Right. So today I'll be talking. Yesterday I was talking about deletions and insertions. Today I'll be talking about point substitutions. And I really didn't know what is known and what is not known by the audience. So I'll start from the very beginning, and you tell me where to speed up, where to slow down. Okay.
Don't ask any questions.
Okay. All right. It's either boring or really clear. Okay. So I just first very. I'm showing chemical formula of the four nucleotides, and I'll get back to the to this formula later when we talk about the details of point mutations. So, as you probably all know, there are just introducing the terms. There are four nucleotides, four bases, T, C, G, A. Each one is attached to the five and to a sugar. And so that's the backbone of DNA and the sugar attached here at the ends. And T's is complementary to A and G's complementary to C through these hydrogen bonds. And there are three hydrogen bonds between G and C and two hydrogen bonds between A and T. Okay? And these are called purines, A and G. These guys are called pyrimidines, T and C. Pyrimidines. The way I remember it, they have longer name, but they're smaller, and purines have a short name, but they're longer, they're bigger. That's the only way I can remember it. Let's see. So changes between pyrimidines are called transitions, and between two pyrimidines and between two purines are called transitions, and between pyrimidine and purine, and purine and pyrimidine are called transversions. And there are more ways to have a transversion than to have a transition, right? So there are four transversions and two transitions. Okay, so that's the background. All right. So it's a multimedia presentation. All right. Okay, so first I'll start from the acknowledgments, because I forgot the acknowledgments yesterday, and I'm afraid I'll forget them today. So all of the work that I was talking about yesterday and today was done when I was a graduate student in Dick Lunton and Don Hart's labs at Harvard, and I really benefited from comments, especially by Dick and by another graduate student there, Mark Siegel. And these are all the collaborators. Particularly Duda Bensasan, she worked out the estimate of the rate of DNA loss in grasshoppers that I was talking yesterday. And Kerry Shaw, Tang Sanster, and Spencer Johnston participated in the estimate of rate of DNA loss in crickets. So I just want to make sure that it's out there. Okay. So the problem, as I presented yesterday at the beginning, is the same for point substitutions as it is for deletions and insertions. You know, everybody understands that mutation is the first cause of evolution. And just as it is for deletions and insertions, measuring patterns or rates and patterns of point mutations, very difficult. They're too slow, so you can't measure them directly. You're trying to infer them from the observed variation, have a problem of natural selection bias. So the justice for deletions and insertions, the estimates of mutational patterns were made using pseudogenes beginning of the 80s by Li Guochibor-Ney. And again, for 20 years after that, there were no other estimates. So that was considered sort of the estimate of a pattern point mutation. And the estimate that they got was as follows. So here I represent six types of changes, right? So you have a change. So there are 12 types of changes from each nucleotide to another nucleotide. So four nucleotides, each can change to three others. So there's 12. But because DNA has a complementary strand, when A changes to a T, the complementary T also has to change to an A. And if you average out mutation patterns across both strands, then the numbers of A to T changes have to be the same as numbers of T to A changes. And so really what you're talking about is a change of a nucleotide pair to another nucleotide pair. So you collapse 12 changes to 6 changes. And so these are the 6 changes. These 4 are transversions, and these 2 are transitions. And the major sort of lesson that was learned from that exercise was that transitions are more common, and that's how people refer to it, you know, transition-transversion bias. Transitions are more common than transversions. But in fact, if you actually look at the pattern, there's one type of transition that's more common than transversions. It's GC to AT change. Some of it is due, and I'll talk about it more later, to the fact that some of the cytosines in mammalian DNA are methylated. And again, I'll talk about it later. And that increases the rate of substitution. But not all of the difference is due to that. So if you, even if you remove all the methylated cytosines and leave only non-methylated, you know, this would be about here. So it will still be higher. Yeah.
Every evidence, did they just assume symmetry of the strands, or did they actually look at them?
They looked at a bunch of pseudogenes and they checked for complementarity. So they counted up the numbers of A to C changes and T to G changes, and they looked to see whether they were the same numbers. And they were the same numbers. Yeah. It's just a percentage. So sorry, this is a relative rate. So they all add up to 100%. So one way to think about it, if you have a strand with 25% A, 25% C, Gs and Ts, and you have 100 events, this is the these are the expectations.
Question, is this reversible? In other words, I see that the GC to AT is a lot faster than AT
That's right.
to GC. Which means if this were reversible, I'd expect lots more ATs and GCs.
So if you run this forever, you're going to end up with an AT-rich piece of DNA.
Right.
Right. So that eventually they're just more ATs, they're changing slower, but there are more of them, so the total number of changes becomes identical.
Right. And so the question is, right now, are we at that equilibrium distribution in terms of ATs versus GCs?
So some sequences probably are, some sequences probably aren't. Uh-huh. And again, I'll talk about it more in particular application to Drosophila. Yes?
How much attention do they pay to different pseudogenes in different regions, for example, IPCOR?
This is a very good question. These pseudogenes are all from AT-rich regions of the mammalian genomes. So, and so that's one of the reasons why it's AT-biased. Yeah. They didn't specifically look for them, it so happened. If you look back at where the pseudogenes that they picked out come from, they come from more AT-rich regions. Okay, so that's the pattern. Has everybody attended yesterday's talk? I don't know. So can I just skip through the approach? Okay, so I used exactly the same approach, except that you know, now, instead of looking at rate of deletions to point substitutions, I just take all of these point substitutions on the terminal branches, and I treat them as pseudogene substitutions, okay? And I do it both for melanogaster and for Berylis. I'll be talking about the Drosophila set. I'm going to skip that part, but the patterns in melanogaster dataset and Berylis dataset turn out to be identical, so I just pulled them together. Okay, but later I'll tell you that it's really not a true characterization because Drosophila are variable. I happen to pick two groups that have similar patterns. Okay, so first, what kind of data did I get? You get pretty good data using this method because get it from a large number of sequences. So the total number of events I got was 585 substitutions, and there are 12 types of events in principle. So the number of events per bin is pretty large, so it's statistically powerful. But because there are many sequences, the average number of substitutions per site in each sequence was low. And that's one of the problems that people face when they try to estimate mutational patterns is the problem of multiple hits. That, you know, Either you don't have enough events to have statistical power, or you have enough events, but then you run into a problem that the same site has mutated possibly multiple number of times. So when you see A changing to C, you don't know whether it changed. A changed to a G, then to a T, then to a C. So it's very hard to identify events. And the rule of thumb is that if you have less than 10% divergence, then you can, you don't have to worry about multiple hits, because then the probability of a double hit is about 1%. And so in this case, all of the sequences were much less diverged than 10%. So multiple hits are not a problem. Okay. So then we can test for complementarity. And these are now 12 types of events. And you can see that the number of complementary changes are similar, right? Now, it's not necessarily the case that complementarity rules should hold, because let's say it's known that if you look at an individual strand of DNA, then complementarity rules don't have to hold. They hold only if you average over both strands of DNA. So if in bacteria, if you look at the leading strand of replication, then you're going to get a different pattern of mutation if you look at the lagging strand. And maybe if you look at the transcribed strand of DNA, you're going to get a different one than non-transcribed, because transcription by itself either causes mutation or brings to that place repair enzymes. And so things can be different if you limit yourself to single strand. In this case, even if there is such a pattern in Drosophila genome, I probably can't observe it, because my elements land, whichever way to whatever orientation is meaningful, right? So they're not transcribed, and if particular strand has a different pattern than the other, some elements land like this, some elements land like this, and I average it over some random sequence, some random direction in my element. So that's one reason why the complementarity rules hold. Which is a good thing on one hand, but on the other hand, it means that this method only gives you some sort of averaged pattern of mutation and doesn't give you individual pattern of mutation for, let's say, transcribed versus non-transcribed, and some other methods have to be used to do that. Yeah?
Do you think you could run a test on whether individual sequences tend to be
one way or the other? So I don't know how they land.
Yeah, but just whether there's a tendency within each individual sequence to go one way or more the other.
Relative to what? Relative to what?
Relative to whatever orientation they're in, which you don't happen to know.
Meaning whether individual sequences do not have complementarity within them?
Yeah.
Again, because individual sequences, only have, seven events or three events or something like that. The good thing about the method is that individual sequences have very few events in them. And so for individual sequences, I can't really do much statistics.
Cumulatively, you might be able to.
Well, cumulatively, as soon as I do cumulatively, I ruin the pattern. All right? Just because I can't sum them up in any way, because I don't know whether they're landing in the same orientation or not for different elements. Okay. So, but because complementarity rules hold, I can collapse the complementary types and look at the base pairing changes.
The replication center is not known?
No, it's not known. So people tried to clone them from Drosophila by trying to clone pieces of DNA that would serve as replication centers in yeast, and they succeeded. But when they looked at what they cloned, they basically cloned anything that's AT-rich worked. And so it's not known. And they probably, what's known is that the number of replication centers varies. So early in the embryonic development, there are a lot of replication centers because replication is very fast. Later, there are fewer. But nobody knows what's happening in germline cells, which is what matters for this analysis. Okay. So, and this is the pattern in Drosophila. Again, this is a relative rates. Hopefully, these numbers add up to 100. So what are the conclusions? Well, one of the conclusions is that mutation Drosophila is extremely non-random. Right? And the other is that one type of the transition, C2T or G2A, is the most frequent class. And others basically are of the same frequency. So the other type of the transition, in fact, is rarer than some of the transversions. So I have my personal, I don't know what you call it. I'm trying to get rid of the term of transition transversion bias in molecular evolution, because there's really no such thing in terms of the mutation. There is a bias towards C2T change, and others are more or less similar in frequency. Yeah.
It's worth pointing out that, I mean, a lot of that reason is because a lot of people work with mitochondria, which are very different. I mean, they do have a strand bias.
They do have,
and they have
but
a
they don't also.
High transition rate to both.
But again, not because they are not identical. So it's a misnomer to lump all transitions in one class as frequent, and transverse in another class. The reason they do it is because all that you can see when you look at two strands of DNA and you see a change, you see that it's either C change to T or T change to C. And if you lump these together, right? If you don't know the direction of the change, then you can't. When you can't say that whether it changed from C to T or T to C, and you lump these together, they together are more frequent than transversions lumped together. But if you did know the direction, you would know that much of the difference is due to this class and not to this one. Yes.
Just,
is there a question?
Which one is more energetically stable, GC or
AC? GC is more energetically stable.
I'm thinking one of the problems is that this is sort of including two effects. One is the sort of the background distribution, and the other is the transition transversion ratio.
What's the background distribution?
In other words, this equilibrium distribution of APs and GCs.
Oh, no. I calibrated it to.
Right. But what I'm thinking how the rate matrix is often represented in terms of transition and a transversion rate.
Yeah.
You know, n times these factors, which reflect the ultimate equilibrium distribution, and so that if you have something weighted towards a very high AP content, it would bring the AP GC down and the GC AP up. Right.
Yes.
It would still mean, and it wouldn't mean that this model where you have the transition transversion rate being different and the four different background frequencies.
So because they're just more ATs in the sequence.
Right.
But that's, I mean, people really talk about, more of the time, they talk about the probability of a change of a particular nucleotide per unit time, not the cumulative number of events that you're going to observe in a sequence. And it's. I think it's because normally when you compare it to sequences, you can't tell the direction. All you can say that once upon a time, this was a C, and now there is a T there. But you don't know, now the sequences are different. One has C, one has a T. You don't know what happened, right? Whether C changed to a T or T changed to a C. You call it a transition. And so you lump these two together. Okay? So now let's see whether it's different from the mammalian pattern. Oh, no, that's not what we're going to look. What we're going to look now is we're going to look at the equilibrium predictions, right? So you can, these were point estimates of the rates. We can think of what kind of AT content we're going to get if we just run this pattern forever. And to my great satisfaction, the predicted AT content of neutral Drosophila DNA that's been under this pattern forever is about 65% AT, and the AT content of the Drosophila introns, which you can take as rough surrogates of neutral DNA that's been evolving under this pattern, is also about 65% AT. So it does seem like the pattern makes sense. Question? All right, so this was the mammalian pattern that was derived or observed in the 80s. And so this is the Drosophila pattern. So first conclusion is that they are different. And they are different. They, you know, in both cases, C2T transition or GC2AT transition is the most common one, but it's much more common, relatively speaking, in mammals than in Drosophila.
You mentioned that the race is different also in different regions of Drosophila.
Not for regions of Drosophila, for regions of mammalian genome.
So I
don't have the, so that's one caveat in all of this. So this is from the more AT-rich regions of the mammalian genome. It probably is different in the GC region, but there's not, we don't have enough data to really build a pattern like this. So I also mentioned that part of the reason for this is that mammalian DNA is methylated, right? And so it could be that all of the difference here is due to the fact that mammalian DNA is methylated and Drosophila DNA is not methylated. So Drosophila DNA is actually is methylated, but not in germline cells. There's a very transient period when it's methylated, and it was found out like 6 months ago. One way to check for it is just look for the pattern except for this transition. So if you look at other types of mutation, then there is no difference between Drosophila and mammals, at least for these types of mutations in this isochore. And I'm not showing it here, but if you also eliminate all likely positions where cytosine can be methylated in mammalian genome, you also don't get any difference. So
did you look at
if you look at the transversion, also there's no difference.
No, no. If you look at the transversion only, then the GC2TA
is also significantly higher than the
AT2TA. More than 50% higher. Not a factor of two, but very significant.
Yeah, that's right. So
another thing that it may be a second order effect, but maybe not so small, is that I suppose these things are already, on the average, AT-rich. So the fact that GC to AT is larger would be magnified. Right?
Well, so when I derive this, I take into account that it's a non-50% sequence. So it's this pattern is if you had equal frequencies of all nucleotides. So it's per nucleotide rate. Okay. But it's similar in Drosophila. So, and there's no methylation there. So Drosophila, in some sense, is a good check for all the theories of methylation-driven mutation.
No, but when you take away the methylation, you don't only change the GC, you change other stuff as well.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So, okay, so right now, it looks like, to me, the result was surprising that mutational patterns of organisms as divergent in Drosophila mammals turn out to be that similar, right? I thought, well, from this result, it looked like the only real determinant of the difference in mutation pattern is methylation. Also, it could also just be a coincidence. You just take two points and they may be similar, even though there are so many degrees of freedom here that I was surprised to find this similarity. So to check for it, I just looked at the pattern of mutations in the other one that I had in crickets, and these are the same crickets that I was looking at yesterday. And this is the pattern that we get in crickets. So the crickets here are in green. And again, the the only difference that we see is in the rate of C to T transition, and in crickets is much more like it is in mammals. Okay, so there are differences, but it's kind of it's marginally significant. I don't know whether it's significant or not, and we need to get more data to really to answer this question. But I was sort of surprised to find this that CTT transition was that much higher than in Drosophila, and we don't know whether cricket DNA is methylated or not in germline. So to test for it, So if you remove this part, then crickets look very much like Drosophila, and they remain marginally significant with mammals. So to test for methylation, I took all cytosines and all guanines, but to simplify, I just say for cytosines, and I separated them into which neighbor they have, because it's known that methylation generally happens in CG dinucleotides. So if the difference is driven by methylation, then CG dinucleotide, C in the CG dinucleotide should mutate faster than other Cs. And I did not find any pattern of the sort. So maybe you can tell me that I'm doing it wrong. But so these are three types of mutation from cytosine, right? No, sorry. These are all crickets. These are all crickets. So this C, you find this C here, and then you look for where it can change. And what I wanted to see whether this white bar would be much higher proportionately than in this case than to others. And I could not find a significant difference. Again, maybe I don't have enough data, and we need to go and look for methylation. Okay, so so that's a kind of it's an unanswered question as far as I'm concerned right now, whether whether it's methylation driven, but doesn't look like it is.
Can you just say what would happen?
Why would it be higher, or what would happen?
What pattern were you looking for?
I was looking for a pattern where, for these Cs, proportionately, this was much, much greater than others. So let's say these white bars would be here, and this one would stay here. That's what I was looking for.
And the chemical mechanism for that would be...
And I'll get to that in a second. Okay? What?
These patterns are for the crickets.
So here, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to see, is it? My observation is that C to T transitions are much more frequent in crickets than are in Drosophila, and my hypothesis for the same difference in mammals and Drosophila is that mammalian DNA is methylated. So I'm saying, is it likely that the same reason is operating here, or the same cause is operating here? And to test for that, I say, okay, if there's methylation, it's likely to be limited to particular kinds of dinucleotides. At least that's what we know from other organisms. And then much of the excess of C2T transitions should come from a particular kinds of cytosines, namely the ones that have a guanine in it as its neighbor. And so these bars should be reduced because they're not in methylated cytosines, right? But I don't have that pattern to...
I don't think everybody here knows about this CG methylation. You'll talk about it?
About CG methylation?
The channel, the CG, what's special about CG and if it's methylation?
I'll try to explain why methylation increases mutation rate. Not what's special about CG methylation, but maybe, yes?
The G test is just on the CG?
The G test, no, it's on the relative frequencies.
Right, but that's the white bar.
Yeah.
And not the others.
So.
Not C goes to A or C goes to T. The white bar is C goes to T, yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you happen to just, as a control, try neighboring residues on the other side?
No, I didn't. It would be good, but if I had found the pattern, I probably would have done controls to see whether it's, but I didn't find anything. So the next thing to do is just to go and try to see whether there's methylation in the genome, in the germline cells, but I just didn't get to that. It could be that we're mistaken, that not in every organism methylation is limited to particular dinucleotides, right? So that could be one explanation for this.
This may be a little bit accidental, but in HIV, there's a lot of people who have a strong belief that there is a dinucleotide bias.
Mutation.
Yeah, I forget which way it is, but perhaps it's methylation.
All questions of neighboring rates I cannot address yet because I just don't have enough data. Right? So the number of classes that you get once you start looking at the neighbors just expands very quickly. So I just need to get more data before I can answer that question. Okay, so I want to now kind of try to summarize it and give some chemical reasons for why you would expect these things and just kind of what it could mean. Yeah.
Have you looked for correlation the other way? So if it's something else seen?
I didn't, but it's a kind of problem that I'm going to be doing so many multiple tests. Eventually, I'll find something, right? And here at least I have some a priori reason to believe that I should find something here. Whereas, if I start looking everywhere, one removed, two removed, okay. So, what could it be? So, just the transition transversion bias is very famous because of the genetic code. So, so this is the genetic code. And if you can see that practically or vast majority of synonymous substitutions are due to transition substitutions, right? So, say A to G or C to T, not here. here it's the case. So all twofold degenerate sites are different because of transitions. And other people have also tried to see how good the genetic code is in terms of how likely do you get amino acid substitutions that are between similar amino acids when you have transitions versus transversions. And again, I'm correct, right? So that transitions are more likely to lead to more similar amino acids. So the pattern that we're observing now, at least just starting to see, that the pattern of mutation is constant across taxa, or sort of constant in its general rough outline, with one type of transition more common than all other mutations, could be a result of, well, first it could be a coincidence, so we need to get more, but if it's not a coincidence, then it could be a result of sort of co-evolution of mutational pattern to the genetic code, right? So genetic code was a frozen accident, it was like this, and then mutation has evolved to have more transition than transversion because it reduced the deleterious mutation rate. It could be that way around. It could be that mutation was like that from the beginning days, and it's just, this is what happens to DNA in water. Look, there's nothing more to it than that.
It must be the second way around, sure.
Okay.
Because the first way doesn't make sense. The first way is selection.
Right? Yeah.
If you were arguing that the number of transitions you see is large because of selection, then the genetic code would provide a reason for selecting those types of changes, yeah?
That's right.
When you're really measuring the mutation,
yeah,
then the genetic code is irrelevant to that thing.
No, but you can imagine that there's a second order event where you have modifiers in mutation rate being selected because they reduce deleterious mutation rate in the genome. So you select for DNA polymerase that produces proportionately more transitions than transversions.
I mean, people. It's even this underlying mutation, right? It's not really underlying chemistry.
Oh, it's never. It's, I mean, you don't know, right? So you never know what's real underlying, what's not. To me, was the surprising thing was the constancy of it, because of vast difference in proteins that operate on DNA and repair DNA and all the other things. And so, I expected more that it would be more labile than it is. So the other possibility is that mutation rate was constant in genetic code, in some sense, co-evolved with it, again, to reduce, either to reduce deleterious mutation rate, or, I don't know how else to think about it, but.
Well, it's happened simultaneously.
What?
Or it was a co-evolution process where both things are being or, simultaneous.
That's right. So there's, slight, I think one can make sort of a weak argument that it must be the second one thing from the fact that only one type of transition is more common than the other, than others. Because in this case, if the pressure was to reduce transition rate relative to transversion, it doesn't matter which way it goes, right? A and G are equivalent. And so it's unclear why you would select for a particular type of a transition, not the other one. It's not directly predicted.
Yeah, I'm still unconvinced with this. In other words, it seems that, again, I'm not convinced that when you normalize for the background frequencies in terms of the equilibrium distributions,
yeah.
That the transition, which ones are on the right again?
Transitions.
Yeah. Rates are that different. In other words, that if you sort of separate it out into a base composition dependence and a amino acid dependence,
he's thinking of the lambda, he's calling the base of lambda and the lambda client standard reversible model.
Right. So you take all the pies out.
No, I understand. So you're saying that you can have much higher rate toward, toward G's or toward A's, right? And so then, you'll have every codon will be like this, and will be very few like this. And so the total number of the mutations from here to here and to here to here will be identical. I mean, equilibrium, it will be true. It's
right?
But nevertheless, you don't expect that kind of process where you select for more mutations between these guys relative to jumps between to select one particular change and not the other. It could be, it was easier to select for that one than the other, but I'm just saying it's not a direct prediction of the hypothesis. And that's why I said it's a very weak kind of suggestive thing.
Are there reasons why the so I think with heterophiles there's a good reason for GC, high GC content in general. Is there a
so you would think, yeah.
What?
So one would think.
Is there a good reason for a general bias towards AP rich regions in terms of a selective
event? Well, one could always come up with something.
My
heart is closer to the second one anyway. That it's just this is what happens to DNA in water, that just cytosines are more mutable than thymines. And there is some chemical reason to believe that that might be the case. I'll throw that at you. Right, so let's see. On the left is drawn, again, a cytosine, right? So this is the major form. That's what you see in the textbook all the time. But it turns out that about 10 to minus 4 at the time, cytosine exists in a less favored state where this hydrogen moves to this nitrogen. And so you end up with a double bond between carbon and nitrogen. And this conformation actually pairs better with an adenine than with a guanine. And so if you replicate your DNA, every 10,000th cytosine at the time when you're trying to pair it up will look to you like a thymine in terms of pairing. And so you'll stick in an A. Now there is a proofreading function that then goes back and tries to see whether it's the right base or not. And so the story for the evolution of the proofreading capacity is that it was driven exactly by this chemistry, because without the proofreading capacity, the minimum mutation rate that you can get is 10 to minus 4 in cytosines. So it's a fast equilibrium, yeah. Well, but then there are so many cytosines. So in a B form of DNA, every 10,000th cytosine looks like a thymine. So that could be one of the reasons.
Well, if there is a mistake, then the chemical balance maybe shifts the role a bit more that way.
No, so once there is a mistake, it immediately starts looking again like a cytosine, right? Because then it's a particular cytosine that exists majority of the time in that form. What?
Depends on the lifetime. It must be stable for a time which is sufficient to be
rebuilt. Yeah. Yeah.
For a very short period, which is adds up to 10 to the minus 4, then it's different.
So if DNA polymerase puts the nucleotide for a while and waits, and then make sure that it's the right one. But I mean, in some sense, that's what happens with proofreading, because even if it puts in something fast, then it goes back and checks whether it's a good match.
That's occurring at a millisecond.
Yeah. That's right.
But this number 10 to the minus 4, is it obtained by looking at a single cytosine molecule, or is it already in the
context? I actually don't know how it's obtained. I think it's obtained by looking at the B form of DNA. So just the standard form of double-stranded DNA. But I don't know how chemists obtained the number.
Specifically, do you have any idea what the rate of exchange between those two forms is compared to the rate of the amount of time that the A has to sit in the ribosome matching?
Not ribosome, I mean DNA polymerase.
I mean, yes, sorry, the polymerase, but I mean before it, as it's bound to the C before it's connected.
I don't know, except that because of proofreading, this is much faster than the amount of time the DNA polymerase spends on making sure that it's the right nucleotide, whichever way it is, right? So it probably, right? Well, it's got to be. And we know that the mutation rate is not 10 to minus 4. It's close to 10 to minus 9, right? So this, I'm just suggesting that it could be one possibility for a reason that there's this persistent, very frequent particular error that's created that, only in 0.01% gets through, but maybe actually overwhelms the system compared to other kinds that don't have this persistent change in a particular direction. Actually, similar chemistry exists for adenine as well, where this hydrogen goes to this nitrogen, and again, the adenine becomes pairs up better with the cytosine than not.
And that also is 10 to minus 4.
Yeah, something similar. All right. So that could be it. One more thing I wanted to just show you some chemistry of is sort of the explanation of why methylation would increase mutation rate. Methylation of cytosine. So this is on the top this is a standard form of cytosine. And deamination is basically when you have ammonia. This is hydrolyzed, and you have ammonia coming out. And when you have this, so this NH2 group is replaced by hydrogen. And this now looks like a uracil, right? So, and this is a natural base pair in RNA, but not in DNA. So this reaction, so this deamination happens all the time, right? But every time it happens, you have a uracil sitting in the middle of your DNA, and there are special enzymes that recognize uracil in DNA and cut it out. So if you have a standard cytosine, deamination is recognizable and specifically repaired. In methylation, you add a methyl group over here such that now when you have a deamination happening, it's going to look like a thymine. And that is not recognized. It's a natural base pair in DNA. So that's believed to be the reason for an increased rate of C2T mutation in methylated cytosines. And methylation of cytosines is believed to, it's a secondary modification of DNA. It's believed to be a signal that's used for regulation of gene expression and other things. But it does have this cost of increasing mutation rate. Okay?
Yeah. Were there any alternatives? I mean, could you look at this and say, gee, this is silly. If they just moved that proton over here, this wouldn't be a problem, or anything like that?
You know, I don't know chemistry enough to know that. The belief that that's kind of the people. That's why people believe that there is a separate base in uracil. So you know, it's possible that DNA originally had the same base pairs as RNA, and then the methyl group was removed such that this frequent deamination would be recognizable. So that's the story for the fifth base pair.
That means in RNA, if you leave it sit there on a while,
then it becomes used. Yeah, but in RNA you don't care about that because it's so unstable anyway. It's right. It doesn't store genetic information the same way. But again, you know, they don't have a very long lifetime. Well, I mean, this happen. If you care about germline rate of mutation and you're trying to, I mean, relative to that, it's much different time scales.
Well, there's large. I mean, there's large numbers of other RNAs that aren't.
Yeah. So I mean, just it's really not a problem for that. All right, so I've been trying to convince you basically now that mutation pattern is constant, period. And now I'm going to try to show you that it's not constant, and in fact it has a role to play. So the dialectic part of the talk is coming up. And it's basically I'm almost done. First, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about GC content. One thing is GC content has not really been measured in a large number of organisms. There's a dearth of knowledge there. It's been measured in a lot of bacteria, but it has not really been measured in a lot of eukaryotes. Why, I don't know. So in bacteria, the range of GC content is tremendous, and not everybody is AT rich at all. So some of them are 25% AT. Some are 75% AT. So yesterday I was talking about the C-value paradox in eukaryotes with a tremendous range of genome sizes in eukaryotes and very tight range of genome sizes in bacteria. I didn't talk about it, but that's the fact. For GC content, the reverse is true. So that bacteria have tremendous variation and eukaryotes don't. So the question is, in bacteria, which forces are responsible for changing GC content? And it looks like, at least in those cases where people look, is that the mutation pressure is probably the main force and not not selection. Even though there are many theories for why you would want to have selection on GC content, for example, thermostability of DNA. There's also a theory that bacteria that live on top of soil have a lot of UV hitting them all the time, and UV creates a particular kind of mutation of two thymines becoming thymine dimer, which is very difficult to deal with. And so you want to have a more GC-rich DNA so that the probability of two thymines being right next to each other is reduced, or something like that. But so for right now, when people sort of try to look for evidence of selection or evidence of mutation pattern driving the situation, mutation seems to be winning. And so what this is the graph showing the codon GC content in first, second, and third positions relative to sort of the average genome GC content in different bacteria. And the idea is to see which codon position responds to the change in GC content more than others. And it's clear that the third position, the synonymous position, is the one that responds the most. The second one responds the least, and the first one responds a little bit more. And it corresponds to the genetic code, where third positions are more likely to be synonymous, second ones are almost never synonymous, and first ones once in a while are synonymous. X-axis, which was cut off, unfortunately, is the average GC content of the genome.
So what is this supposed to demonstrate?
It's supposed to demonstrate that whatever force is affecting GC content of the genome is such that much of the impact is in the third positions. So, for example, the theories which would say that the selection here is on thermostability of amino acid proteins. It's probably not true. So I forgot to tell you one thing, that the GC-rich amino acid, not only GC-rich DNA is more thermostable, but also GC-rich amino acids are more thermostable. So
this is demonstrating selection is not at the amino acid
level. The other interesting fact, which I don't have an overhead for it, is that if you separate amino acids into GC-rich, medium GC, and GC-poor, they also respond, as you would predict from just if you change mutational pressure, so that as you lower GC content in the genome, the GC-rich ones respond the most, GC-medium kind of stay put. And so you kind of, by changing GC content of the genome, you also change amino acid sequence of your proteins to kind of to correspond more to the GC content, showing that sort of a large number of amino acids in the proteins are sort of don't really have to be what they are right now. A large number of other amino acids would do as well. And this pattern is more, it's clearer in less constrained proteins. Okay? So, the other piece of information is that, and it's a very recent data from Drosophila. As I was saying, that I had the same pattern mutation in two Drosophila groups. But then there's a group at UC Irvine where they look. I'll just draw it on the board. So. This is about 40, 60, So this is Malnagast group. Varilis. And so here the genomic AT content is about 65%. And if you look at, so if you look at introns and if you look at third positions in not biased genes, so you take the least codon biased genes and you look at the AT content, they're about 65%. And Sultan's group and Stoney, this increased to about 72%. Right, so there's a difference in AT content. And there is a whole range of evidence suggesting that the likeliest explanation for the pattern is that somewhere over here in the ancestor, mutation became more AT rich, more AT biased. Okay. And the kind of evidence that people have is following. There are a lot of little pieces of information. In Drosophila, for unknown, I don't think a known reason, or anybody even has a good idea why, the preferred codons in genes are GC rich, right? So out of 24 preferred codons, something like 23 have a G or a C, and majority of them have a C in the third position. So the fact that mutation is AT biased shows that mutation cannot be the source of the codon bias because codons are biased toward GC. But if there is a change in AT pressure, then you would expect the average codon bias to go down, right? Because it's GC rich. You increase number of mutations toward AT, codon bias should be reduced, should be more toward unpreferred. And that's what you see. So codon bias is reduced here. It's also reduced more in more biased genes. So because they had more G's and C's to mutate. You have change in not only in the third positions, but also the introns of 5' and 3' regions. And you have a whole burst of evolution on amino acid level and synonymous positions happening in the ancestor of Sultan's and Willis Stoney and a number of genes, which is also expected if you had, if you equilibrate your sequences to a particular AT bias, and then you change it at a particular time, you expect to have a burst of mutations until you reach a new equilibrium. And that's exactly what people see here. There's a burst of mutation. And the ratio of synonymous to non-synonymous is, non-synonymous to synonymous is less different from one here than in other lineages. Again, you would expect that from change of mutational pattern. And what I'm trying to do right now, I'm trying to actually go into these groups and measure mutational pattern explicitly and see how it happened. Because from the studies before that I showed you today, it looked like they all seem to stay put. And what I want to know right now, if it's true that mutational pattern can change, I want to know which axes are variable, which axes are not. Okay. And the final point is, which was mentioned before, is that this, like all of this talk, it presumes that there is this overall mutational bias for the organism. And in Drosophila, it more or less is true. So there are no large regions of different, you don't have megabase large regions of similar GC content within and different between. But in mammals, it's more pronounced, even though there are recent studies using complete human genome that show that, it's not as clear as people believed before. But there are regions of sort of similar GC content, and then in stepwise fashion, it goes to a different GC content for another large region. And there is a study that shows that for pseudogenes that are present in GC-rich regions compared to AT-rich regions, mutational patterns vary in those cases. So there's a lot that we don't know about it, right? And so, the last tidbit that complicates the whole thing is that there is a paper that I read the day before I came here, just came out in PNAS, where people showed that it's a French group, I don't know the first name, last name is Duray, it showed that recombination by itself is mutagenic, and recombination is mutagenic in a way that it promotes mutations toward G or C, right? So, which complicates things tremendously, because there was a pattern in Drosophila that there was more codon bias in regions of high recombination, and we can discuss it after coffee break, that was taken as evidence of more efficient selection for codon bias in regions of high recombination. But now it looks like, no, the reason there is more codon bias in regions of high recombination is that recombination creates mutations toward GOC, and codon bias in Drosophila happens to be such that it's GC rich, so that as a result you see change toward high codon bias. And the way they found it out is that they looked at those preferred codons that were not GOC, and they found that for those codons, codon bias actually went down and not up. And the overall codon bias went up simply because you had the majority preferred codons that are GOC. Okay. So the whole thing is a big mess right now. We really don't have much data, and in order to do it properly, one would need to gather much more data from different organisms and also within organisms from different parts of the genome. One would need to do it for transcribed sequences, not transcribed sequences, sequences that are in one direction in terms of replication, another direction, high recombination regions, low recombination regions, and we're not anywhere close to being there. And I'm done.
Your cricket data, the native, the virus, CG2AT was even higher.
That's right.
And what was your prediction of the stable AT content?
It would be more AT rich. I didn't do it because I didn't have anything to compare it with.
I see. So.
I'm planning just to, again, I picked it originally because it was not characterized, and so I'm paying the price now that I have to characterize it.
Yeah. Also, in a minute, the stable concentration would be higher than 65.
It's a little higher than 65, and it.
What would be a mechanism? Making different regions of the genome having different mutation rates?
So, one most common idea is that different regions of the genome are replicated at different times. And you can have just different concentrations of different nucleotides, right? So one way, one very easy way to bias your mutational pattern is that if you're at a particular time, you only have A and T floating around, and you never have G and C. So, DNA polymerase will wait and wait and wait for the G. It will never get there. It will stick an A, right? So, you can just bias your mutational pattern like that, and so that could be one reason. Another.
You would not see sort of a pattern from one region to another.
If some regions are, if let's say some regions are replicated at different times, and it's known that different regions of chromosomes are replicated.
Always at that time.
always at the time. And it's known, so you know, the telomeric regions are replicated one time, centromeric regions are replicated another time. So there is a consistency of the time of replication of different regions of chromosomes. And if it persists for a long time, then you will end up with these isochores. Another possibility is it's a kind of feedback loop where GC-rich isochores are gene-rich. And if you have a lot of, let's say, if methylation is involved in gene regulation, methylation can drive, so in those regions you'll have higher rate. So if you have methylation in gene-poor regions because you know, you just want to shut down anything that's there, say all transposable elements, then there you'll have you know, proportionately higher rate of mutation toward T's. And then you know, eventually you'll create sort of regions which are gene poor and GC rich, and regions that are gene rich and GC rich, and gene poor and GC poor.
So that's differential methylation.
Differential methylation.
So
as I said, so if you have original imbalance, and let's say there's so you have some original non-equal distribution of genes and non-equal distribution of transposable elements in some repeated sequences, and there is some specific methylation of repeated sequences, which is known to happen, then you know, that region will become more AT-rich, and you know, and it's also maybe at the same time becomes a region where gene expression is reduced. And so any translocation of a gene into that region would be deleterious because gene cannot be expressed. And so, and then the transposable elements jump there anyway and persist because they don't interrupt genes there. And they get methylated even more. It drives mutation even more to AT. You know, and so after a while, all genes will concentrate in one place.
That's not what's
observed. That is what is observed. So genes, GC-rich isochores are gene-rich. At least if there's this overall appearance of a pattern. But I don't know whether it's true. Sorry.
Is it really that the rates are different in different regions of the genome, or is it that you see, I don't know,
yeah, so there are, the second is definitely true, but also there was a study by Ockman and Francino in Nature about 3 years ago where they looked at globin pseudogenes and they're found in different isochores. And they expressed the look for what kind of mutations accumulate there. And they found that the mutational pattern was more GC biased for pseudogenes that are in GC rich isochores. So there's at least one study where people look specifically for it. And they make arguments that it's probably mutation and not selection that's affecting it. But that's still controversial. No, but I mean, they.
So because, I don't know, some regions which would be tagged into the genome, I don't know, just 100 million years ago, they wouldn't react to that.
Yes.
So that you still see the initial conditions. That you are still not relaxed in your steady state. You can't infer from that that some rays are different.
So if you don't have an estimate of mutational pattern, you cannot infer simply from the fact that the GC contents are different, that the pattern is different, because GC-rich sequences could have been inserting into that region, and so that's just a signal of the history. That's true, but as I said, so there is some evidence that actual mutational frequencies. So if you compare the same pseudogene in related species and you see what kind of mutations occur there, you see that in a GC-rich region, there are more mutations toward GC. So There is direct evidence of that.
Okay, so you're around till the end of the afternoon, aren't you?
I'm around until tomorrow.